And now, The Mentors Radio, one of the most popular and unique shows on the air today. Here each week, remarkable CEOs and leaders, including host Tom Laurie and Dan Hesse, and their guest will mentor you, challenging your thinking about life and work. Sought after for their ethical leadership and advice, and for helping others succeed throughout their careers, now these same CEOs, the mentors, want to help you achieve your highest level of profitability, success, and personal fulfillment in life, at work, and in business. Learn more and check out the show notes at thementorsradio.com. That's thementorsradio.com. And now, here is your mentor.
Welcome. I'm Tom Laurie, and today we're joined by a man who has dedicated his life to the pursuit of truth in an age of confusion. Jay Budzhivsky is professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin and holds a PhD from Yale University. He is a prolific author of over 20 books, including foundational works like The Revenge of Conscience, What We Cannot Know, What We Can't Not Know, and his most recent work, Pandemic of Lunacy, How to Think Clearly When Everyone Around You Seems Crazy. A former radical atheist and political leftist, he underwent a profound conversion that integrated his world-class intellect with deep faith. Today, he is one of the preeminent voices on natural law and critical thinking. We're exploring what he has learned about the patterns of delusion in our culture and why so many smart people seem to be losing their grip on reality. It's again an honor, Jay, to have you back on the show. Thank you for coming.
Well, you're welcome. It's an honor to be on it again. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, I think for context, I gave a lot of thought. I think it's important to talk about the pandemic of delusion from a content standpoint. We're going to talk about that throughout the show. But to set the context, I want the my audience to know that Jay has a book that includes, let's see, six parts. And he talks about delusions about virtue and happiness, delusions about politics and government, delusions about family and sexuality, delusions about what it means to be human, delusions about what is real and unreal, delusions about God and religion. There are many other delusions in life, but these are the priority delusions that he is covering in his book. And in each of these six parts, he has 30 delusions that he addresses. And some of these we're going to touch on today. We can't cover all of them. We just don't have the time. But good character, one delusion is good character is unnecessary to well-being. That's an important one because we talk on this show a lot about character and the importance of character. Another delusion in part two is democracy is the literal rule of the people. We won't be able to cover that today, but that hopefully is enough to get you to buy his book and take a look at that. Lunacy number 15 in part three, men and women don't need each other. Love to spend some time on that, but we're going to probably skip over that today. Maybe we'll touch on it. And part four, human nature is merely animal, and we can transcend human nature. We're going to talk a lot about human nature today because we're going to get some of the root issues. Part five, we talk about, well, two of them I picked out, is each person has his own reality, and this is something that I really want to talk about today. Things like my reality and your reality, my truth and your truth, which I hear a lot of. Things are whatever we say they are, because there are a lot of people running around saying things that aren't true that they say they are true. And then finally, we're going to close with delusions about God and religion, because this is really the path to sanity. And we'll spend time on that. So so one thing I want to start out with, it's, and we mentioned it last week in our rep call. You're teaching undergraduates, and I'm sure you have some graduate students that you take care of. And in the undergraduate school, I mean, what your book and what you stand for and what you're doing is a little bit counterculture to what's going on in academia.
Yeah, it is countercultural, and I've had pushback. It's interesting that I've had more pushback from some colleagues than from students. My students tend to be a sort of a self-selected bunch. They know what they're in for, many of them, when they enroll in my courses. But I get some who don't, or who want to, or who enroll just because they want to argue with me, and I get some pretty hard pushback from them too. It is countercultural. These lunacies themselves used to be countercultural, but now they're mainstream. And people to challenge them threatens a lot of folks.
And why do you think they're mainstream today?
Well, it's most lunacies, I would say all lunacies are motivated. You have a reason for wanting to believe something that's crazy. If you have done something terribly wrong, for instance, it's very convenient to talk yourself into the idea that right and wrong is whatever I make it up to be. If you are completely alienated from God, it's very convenient to talk yourself into believing, well, there's nobody to be alienated from. He doesn't exist, or religion is just about my feelings anyway. If you've been making really foolish decisions in your relationships with the opposite sex, or maybe you haven't, but you've just been burned, then it's you may have motives. You may want to believe, well, I don't need men anyway. I don't need women anyway, or something of that nature. So I think that craziness is this kind of craziness is motivated. I wouldn't say schizophrenia is motivated, or that bipolar disorder is motivated, or anything like that. But what we're talking about is chosen disorders of thinking that we buy our way into.
So, is society really going crazy?
Well, a large part of our society is going crazy, and especially these lunacies seem to be entrenched in our opinion-forming classes, among our elites. There's a much greater reservoir of sanity down below, but there's some craziness there too. For instance, despite the fact that our elites are the ones who push the radical ideas about marriage, that it can be whatever you want it to be, and your children are just as well off if you're not married, actually, those same elites tend to be married and stay married at a much higher rate than working class people and middle class people, who then suffer from what is being foisted on them, because it turns out that isn't true. You're not as well off, you're not as happy, your children are not as well off, things are a mess. You need to have a sane relationship with the other sex.
Well, I wish I were a lot younger. I wish I were at the University of Texas, and I would love to take your course. So stay with us. When we return, we're with Professor Jay Budiszewski, and we're talking about why smart people are often the most delusional. This is Tom Laurie, and you're listening to The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Laurie. Today we're joined by Dr. Jay Budiszewski, professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas in Austin, and author of the book Pandemic of Lunacy. Let's go back to the last segment and talk about the elites, the educators, and tell us more about that and what's going on. Why are they stuck in lunacy?
I have some hopes that might change. There are some new educational initiatives at some schools, including my own school. There's something called the School of Civic Leadership that is being staffed by people who are more sane. But I'll tell you, when I was at Yale, my teachers just took for granted that right and wrong are all relative, and my dissertation supervisor took for granted that virtue is in the eye of the beholder. You can make it up whatever you want. This culture has this idea of virtue. That culture has that idea of virtue, and it's sort of all in our heads. I bought into that big time. I read the German thinker Friedrich Nietzsche. He was the originator of the slogan "God is dead," And Dostoevsky had a version of that, although he didn't believe it himself. God is dead, so everything is permitted. And I really thought that there either wasn't a God, or there was not a God who made a difference to anything, and that that right and wrong and good and evil were things that we made up, that we constructed. They were delusions. And now that doesn't make you happy. That makes you bitterly unhappy to believe that. This was what, in one way or another, I'd been picking this up all during my whole educational career, even in high school. In high school, for example, my teachers wanted to prepare us for the SAT and all those other college prep exams. And so they taught us, they said, well, we have to teach you the difference between fact and opinion. Well, you know, that's a false dichotomy, because an opinion is an opinion about a fact. Even a true opinion, a factually correct opinion, is still an opinion. But we were told things like, well, you were supposed to say opinion if you said marriage is to be between a man and a woman, but you were supposed to say fact if you said, well, the sun is 93 million miles away from the sun. So you see, even in those ways, and I don't think my teachers understood that they were teaching me relativism then, or nihilism, but they were. So I got it all through.
So one of the things, and I mentioned it in the opening about, or as we got into the opening, is I have my truth and you have your truth.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, it's
the lunacy of that.
Well, it is lunacy. I remember speaking to a woman. She was a psychotherapist, actually, a Jungian psychotherapist, and she said everybody has their own truth. And I said, do you mean that everybody believes different things about what is true? And she says, no, you don't understand me. I don't mean they believe different things are true. I mean they have different truths. And I said, do you mean, for example, I'm married to Sandra, but you're married to Scott, and she, you know, different facts are true about you and about me. No, not that. I pitched all kinds of things. Do you mean this? Do you mean this? Things that made sense. And finally I said, well, if what you were saying was true, we'd have to be in different universes. And she said, now you've got it. We are. And I said, but in that case, we couldn't talk to each other. Now it was, you know, it was convenient. It was motivated for some reason. She wanted to believe that we were all in different realities, and so what you said could be true. A student in one of my classes once, we were discussing the natural law. We were discussing the nature of marriage, and he said, "Well, we can define marriage to be whatever we want it to be, can't we?" Well, of course you can write any definition that you want to. You can define a dog to be a cat. You can define a star to be a pebble. That doesn't make the dog a cat. That doesn't make the star a pebble. What a definition ought to do is express the reality of the thing. If you changed all the dictionaries and said that dogs were a species of cat, well, you could do that, but you'd run into difficulties, right? Because these cats would bark and others would meow and some of them would chase the others and they couldn't mate with each other. Why are you calling them the same species? It's merely a linguistic change.
Listening to the Mentors Radio, I'm Tom Laurie. I am with University of Texas Professor Jay Budziewicz. So go ahead with that.
I was saying then was but people buy it, because it can be, if you want to say, well, you know, I mentioned that it might provide an excuse to believe something like that if you're living in a disordered way, but it can also provide you with a conversation stopper. If somebody says, oh, you think so and so? Well, why do you believe that? If you just say, well, everybody has his own truth, you're exempted from the responsibility of answering the question. You don't have to give a good reason for anything you say. And so it's a lot easier for people too. It's lazy, but it's a form of laziness that drives you into deeper and deeper craziness.
So a lot of people talk about how polarized we are as a country. And after I went through your book, I mean, the polarization really has to do with being removed from reality and truth.
Yes, I think on many of these issues it is. With some of these issues, for instance, I talk about the idea that democracy is the literal rule of the people, and I say no, it's not really quite that. This you don't have to be totally in cloud cuckoo land to believe that, although I think when examined closely, it turns out to be lunatic too. But some of the others really are. Well, as the kids say, they're out to lunch. It's it's hard to fathom how people could believe them. And you mentioned the polarization of things. Well, take for instance the idea that there are 95 different genders, or that a man can be a fox. You know, the so-called furry movement.
Or a man could be pregnant.
Or a man can be pregnant, or it's just lunatic. I saw a video about a fellow who identified as a dog, and so his friends would throw sticks for him, and he would run on all fours, and he would catch them. Another one videoed herself in a raccoon suit, sitting in a little forest stream and dabbling in the water as she imagined that raccoons do. Well, let me tell you, a raccoon is not going around telling you what he identifies as. Even a mistake like that, even a lunacy of that sort, is something that only a human being can commit. Or people who say, well, I'm going to live like the animals. An animal doesn't say it's going to live like the animals. That's already a human thing. The animal just does. It's the only way he knows. You have to be a human being capable of entertaining thoughts about actual concepts and thoughts about reality to even enter into something as crazy as that.
So in your book, you talk as we get into natural law, you get into animals and humans. Why don't you spend just a minute or two talking about what separates us from animals?
Well,
There's
the biggest
confusion about
thing
that.
there is, the biggest thing is rationality. And I think people misunderstand that because they think rationality means cleverness. There are a lot of animals that are very clever. They can find a way out of a cage. They can figure out a way to open a suitcase. Raccoons are very good at getting into the house. There's some problem solving here. But it isn't rationality. A rational creature is one that's able to entertain concepts of universal truth. To say the cat may be curious about, because it sees it hears a mouse, and it investigates, but the cat isn't thinking to itself, "I have the concept of a mouse. That is a mouse. I like to eat mice. I will go search it." No, it just does do those things. Those are our descriptions of its behavior. That's not its thought process. A dog does not contemplate the beauty of the sunset. And I love animals, okay? I'm not dissing dogs. My cat Chesterton of blessed memory, that was the best cat I ever had. He was great. But you know, he didn't I guess I'd have to say I loved him. I wanted his true good, but he didn't love me. He couldn't form the concept of loving me because love is a commitment of the will to the true good of another person. And will is different than instinct or impulse. It's something that you have to be a rational being to have. We misunderstand these things. We also have
We're going to have
very
to go to break. Have to go to break.
okay.
We're breaking down the myths of my truth versus reality. Don't go away. More with Professor Buderzwisky on the Mentors Radio. Remember, you can also listen to this show or any previous show via podcast on Spotify, Google, and more. Just search for the Mentors Radio on any podcast platform or subscribe at thementorsradio.com. This is Tom Laurie, and this is the Mentors Radio Show.
And now, back to the Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Thanks for staying with us. I'm Tom Laurie, continuing my conversation with the University of Texas professor Jay Buderzwisky about the pandemic of lunacy. So we were talking about animals. I want to switch topics here because there's one I want to make sure we go ahead. You
Can
want
I
to have
say
one
one
more?
more thing
Yeah,
about the
sure.
animals?
Yeah.
You know, you were asking me how we're different from the animals, and I said rationality. But I don't want that to be understood in a narrow way. For instance, people will say, well, Animals mate and we marry, and so we're similar in that way. No, that's actually a profound difference. The animals mate, we mate, but only for a rational creature does is mating elevated into a different dimension by rationality, to giving thought to the future, to think about the well-being of your descendants. The animal has descendants, but it isn't thinking about them. Everything that we do, all the things that we seem to share with animals, are transformed in us by our distinctive, unique rationality, and they become different things. That's all I wanted to say about that.
That would include for humans, saving to put your child through college.
Sure, a squirrel, you might say, well, a squirrel saves. It puts all those nuts in there. It's only acting on instinct. What it does is good for its own survival, but it
Right.
isn't thinking to itself, I must survive. It is good for its offspring's survival, but it isn't thinking, it doesn't even have a concept of offspring. It isn't thinking, I must ensure that they have an adequate food supply. It just does it.
So, one of the things I want to cover, I've got a lot, I mean, I've got a lot to cover, but one of the real problems I see today in our society is that the ends justifies the means.
Oh, yes.
Now, I had the good fortune in college to, they made us, even though I was in engineering, I had to take a philosophy course, and I can remember ends and means and the whole discussion. And it's like people miss out on what that really means. Talk a little bit about the ends justify the means and why that is such a plague and a problem.
I talk about this under the heading, sometimes you just have to do the wrong thing. People will say, well, I know it's morally wrong, but I have to do it because I have to get the results to come out right. Which is another way of saying the ends justify the means. It's saying, I have to play God. You can do what's intrinsically wrong because you have to get the best results, don't you? What if I don't murder this person? Well, then maybe something bad will happen. What if we, maybe he'll get the job instead of me getting the job. Maybe then I won't be able to pay my mortgage. What if I do this? What if I don't do this? You were talking about the existence of God earlier, and it actually has something to do with that too, because if you don't believe in a provident God, so, and you can trust him to take care of the consequences, then the temptation to play God yourself and to say, well, what else would justify the means? I've got to play God myself. I got to make everything come out right. That temptation is going to be almost irresistible. In philosophy, this is called consequentialism. It's the idea that nothing but consequences matter. Now, of course, consequences do matter. I'm not going to cross the street right now because a truck is coming, and the consequence of crossing would be that I get mashed. I will cross now because the truck has passed and it's safe. But consequences aren't the only thing to matter. There are some things that no matter what the consequences are, you must not do. For instance, you must never deliberately take innocent human life. I'm not talking about so-called collateral damage, where somebody denies as an unintended consequence of what you're doing. I'm talking about deliberately seeking the death of an innocent person. That's not just a matter of consequences. It's not just a matter of saying, well, the ends, you can't even kill for the you can't even deliberately take innocent human life for the sake of saving another life. Then you start having to choose. And this is a hard one. This is a hard one for us.
And we see it all the time.
We see it all the time. One of the greatest temptations of politicians. I've known a lot of very ethical soldiers, but throughout history, this has been a great temptation among those in that trade of having to fight for their country. The temptation is to. I knew a guy once who. He didn't tell me, but I strongly suspected that he had been in one of our wars. I strongly suspected that he had done something that violated his own conscience, because he was in one of my classes. He'd come back from military service, and we were talking about just war theory, and his voice would squeak when he talked about this. He would get almost hysterical. He said, "Well, sometimes you just have to violate the rules of just war. Sometimes you have to deliberately target innocents. Sometimes you," and I had a feeling, I know what happened with you, and you can't bear it. And you're adopting this philosophy. You know, we talked about choosing your lunacy because you think it's going to comfort you. And that's not the way to deal with conscience. If you got bad conscience, what you do is repent. You don't try to make yourself think that doing the wrong thing was okay.
My list of things to talk about, and you just got into it, is the revenge of conscience. Talk a little bit more about that, what that really means.
Well, you mentioned that my area of specialization before this is really natural law theory, the natural moral law, the things we can't not know, the moral principles that are built into the design of our nature, so that if we don't live according to them, we are going to be very seriously messed up. Now, you might sometimes people say, well, there must not be a moral law because I don't feel guilty when I do what's wrong. Some of my students have told me that, or they'll say there are such people. But there's a difference between feeling guilty. Feeling guilty is remorse. It's not conscience. And bad feelings are the most malleable, easy to deal with consequence of guilty knowledge. Even if you suppress, I was on a radio show once and I was being interviewed about the revenge of conscience. And I said, you know, you can make these bad feelings go away, but the guilty knowledge comes back in another way. And it was a call-in show. And a guy said, I know exactly what you mean. He said, I'm a drunk. He said, I'm on the wagon now, but I'm a drunk. He said, and when I was drinking, I'd feel guilty about drinking. And so to get rid of the guilty, the feelings of remorse, I drink more. Now that's the revenge of conscience. That's the revenge, you see. When you instead of repenting, you try to make it go away somehow, or you try to suppress your knowledge, you make the feeling go away. And you can succeed in making the feeling go away if you drug yourself enough, but there will be other telltale signs. You might find that you have a compulsion to confess every detail of what you did, except that it was wrong. We think, listen to him blurting all that stuff. He must be shameless. No, it's because of his shame that he's blurting it.
We're going to have to cut. Yeah. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us. Our conversation with Professor Jay Budiszewski continues right after this. You will find all of our past shows, show notes, links at thementorsradio.com. Subscribe to future shows while you're there. This is Tom Laurie, and this is The Mentors Radio Show.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Laurie here with Professor Budiszewski, exploring how to think clearly in today's crazy world. You had a few more thoughts on revenge of conscience.
Yeah, I'll just mention one of the other thoughts. I was commenting on how remorse, people confuse remorse, but that is bad feelings, guilty feelings, with guilty knowledge, with real conscience. And I said remorse is the weakest of the furies that pursue us and seek revenge. And I mentioned that sometimes we may not feel bad, but for reasons we don't understand, we may compulsively confess what we did. Sometimes people used to call that Freudian slips. But there's another thing that's like this too. I call it the fury of reconciliation. You could think, well, how could reconciliation be a bad thing? It isn't a bad thing, but there's a false reconciliation that happens when you don't, a simulated reconciliation that happens when you don't repent. You don't make up with the people that you've hurt. Instead, you break off with them and you form new companions to simulate the restoration of broken intimacy. Or you make up a new god who doesn't mind what you did, so you can and simulate the restoration of broken intimacy with him. Alcoholics have friends, but they lose their old friends. They have to simulate intimacy. People who join criminal gangs are usually immediately expected to do something that shocks even their conscience. Why? Because they have a profound sense that they've broken their relationship with God and man. Well, the only people left to have a connection with are the members of the gang themselves. So conscience has its revenge, even though they won't repent, and drives them further and further and further into craziness.
So one of the things you touched on that I learned years ago, and comes into relationships, and that is if you really want to change your interaction with another person, you need to change yourself first.
Yes, you do. And we try every all sorts of ways of not having to do that. We demand that they change, for instance. Or we say if something went wrong, let's say I've treated somebody badly, to assuage my conscience, instead of repenting and trying to and saying I'm sorry and trying to make up with the person, I may convince myself that the other person is the one who did wrong. That's a bad person. That's a bad person. And then if I'm convinced that they're a bad person, I'm very likely to continue treating them even worse.
So, as you were talking, one of the things, one of the problems too, it seems to me today, is that those that are advocating for certain lunacies prey on our emotions and on our empathy,
Yes.
sympathy, and all. Could you talk to that? Because that's one of the things I see. It's remarkable. Rather than talking about facts or being rational, it's all feeling centered.
Everything's feeling centered. Even you, maybe everybody's seen this sort of thing happen where there's a child and he's stuffing himself with something. I knew a kid once who, when he was near the chocolate dish in his family household, he would, if he saw it, he would stuff it. He would just start stuffing those things in his mouth. But his parents couldn't restrain him or teach him not to be a glutton because they thought, oh, but he wants it, the poor little thing. They thought that they were being cruel. Now, not many people would be that way about gluttony is not one of our favorite sins. It's actually people tend to be down on it, but people are that way about other sins, sexual sins, some sins involving life and death, some sins involving various kinds of dishonesty. We have false compassion. True compassion would mean, I see that this person has done something that's harmful to him, and I have compassion for him. I want to get him back in right relationship with the good. But giving him what he wants is phony compassion. It's false compassion. A young woman in one of my classes once, we were talking about natural law, and I had not been talking about sex, but one of the students asked about sex. We were talking about Thomas Aquinas's view of natural law. And he said, what would Thomas Aquinas think about this sexual behavior? And I said, well, you've studied the theory here enough to be able to work the answer out for yourself. What would you say? And they talked about it. The students talked about it very coolly, calmly, rationally for about 5 minutes and worked out the correct answer as to what he would have thought, what followed from his principles. Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that because it would be harmful to human beings given the way that we're naturally made. A young woman in the front of the class, and you could guess what sort of a life she was living, starts crying. And I said, are you all right? And she said, oh, all this is just so mean. And I said, how is it mean? She said, it's just judging those poor people. It doesn't have any compassion. I said, nobody has been judged. There were some statements made that certain things are bad for people, but if you have compassion for them, don't you want what's good for them? I see, if somebody is taking drugs, the compassionate thing to do isn't going to say, you have an urge for a fix right now, I'm going to give it to you. No, it's going to be saying, buddy, you gotta stop doing this. This is wrecking you. That's true compassion. But we confuse compassion not with tending to the true good of the other person, but with tending to assuaging his feelings.
Oh, in San Francisco, it's well known that they went out and gave drugs to people that were homeless on the streets.
That's just so insane. And how did they get out in the streets in the first place? Not
Exactly.
a lot of them because of the abuse of drugs. It's so hard.
So, how do you, I guess, and we're going to run out of time, we got one more segment to go, but. So you're dealing with somebody that is not that is a lunatic. Let's just put it that way. How do we deal with them? How do we?
Well,
I mean, I've got members in my family, and I hate to say we're polarized. I think there is a real difference in how we think. But if I ask a question just to try and ferret out where they're coming from, they get all upset.
Well, one thing I found is that most people are easier to talk to on a one-to-one basis than in a group. Because in a group, they feel like if they admit that they've made a mistake, or if they confess an error in logic, or that they're believing something is just nuts, they lose face in front of other people, and the other people are pressuring them to go along too. So in situations like that, I don't say much, but I look for opportunities to talk with that person to one-to-one. And often somebody who's been aggressively maintaining line A when he's with the others, when he's with you just face to face, he's going to say, "Yeah, there is a problem there. I know it. I really think B." You can sometimes make progress that way. Another thing that you have to do, and I'm sure you've discovered this, we've all discovered it in our families, you have to stay in a relationship. Somebody may not be able to hear you at a certain point in time. He can't hear you. He can't hear you. Okay, you don't say what he can't hear. But there is going to come a time, maybe it'll be a time when he's way down, he's hit the bottom, when all of a sudden the defenses are weakened. There are chinks in the armor. Some gleams of light are able to get through, and he may be able to hear you, and he may be even want to hear from you. If you don't stay in a relationship, you're not going to be there when that time comes.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. Stay tuned. We're going to continue our conversation with Professor Jay Budiszewski after the break. If you tuned in late or want to hear this episode again, visit thementorsradio.com where you can subscribe and listen to all past episodes for free. This is Tom Laurie, and this is the Mentors Radio Show.
And now, back to the Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Laurie. We're closing out our time with Professor Jay Budiszewski talking about the pandemic of lunacy. So the question at the end of all of that, I mean, we're all living in this period of chaos and so-called polarization. What is the path to sanity? How do we extricate ourselves?
Well, one thing is that we need to be more trustful of common sense. Now, so-called common sense can sometimes be mistaken. We all know that. But the prejudice of the way of our modern educational system is that what we used to call common sense is all just a bunch of hooey, and it's all crazy. And instead, you have to listen to this latest theory from this psychologist or this sociologist or this philosopher or this person. When such theories are sound, what they do is they don't just push common sense out of the way. What they do is purify it. They elevate it. They purge it of its inconsistencies. Elevated common sense is the best kind of philosophy. So with that, in that spirit, I think we have to be more respectful of the common sense of the human race. And I don't mean just the common sense of my class or my nation, but there's a certain common sense of the human race that men and women need each other, for example. And this needs to be respected.
Now, going back, and you talk about it in the book, I mean, these fundamental principles go back in time.
Yes.
Morality, the Ten Commandments. I mean, this is nothing new, what we're
No,
talking
it's nothing
about.
new. The Ten Commandments, the great thing about the Ten Commandments isn't that when God gives the Ten Commandments, he's telling people something that they didn't have a clue about, but rather that it was a clearer expression of things that they dimly already knew. In the book of Exodus, when God gives the Ten Commandments, he says, "What other nation has such good commandments as I've given you?" How could they answer that question unless they had some sense of the moral law already? Why? Because it's written on the heart. It's built into our design. And so then when you hear it, when you're confronted with it, it makes sense. It's like, or to take another example of that, the idea that man is made in the image of God. Does everybody in the world know that man is made in the image of God? No. But on the other hand, we all have a horror of murder and of bloodshed. And to hear that man is made in the image of God makes sense of that intuition that we have and clarifies it. I think another thing that we can do that is helpful is to be scrupulously honest with ourselves. Now, you can't just shut your ears to everybody around you. When we're in a culture that's crazy like this, you can't just stop listening to anybody and say, I'm going to go it alone. We're social beings. We need each other. But you do have to ask yourself questions. Wait, am I just going along with that because somebody just said it? Or does that really make sense to me? Let me think about that. You have to be scrupulously honest with yourself about your own motives. Am I believing that because it's convenient for me to believe that? Or do I have better reasons to believe that than something else? These things, so honesty is real important. And we were talking about this in connection with the revenge of conscience. There is no, when we have done wrong and we know we've done wrong, there's no substitute for repentance. Revenge of conscience, I think, it accounts for a lot of our motivated lunacy.
Yeah, I would agree. So the going back to the what you're just talking about, what, do you have a message of hope? Is the pendulum going to swing?
There's always hope. Now, the thing that makes the thing that makes it difficult about pendulums is this: we've invented all sorts of technologies and pills. You know, people used to do something wrong and feel bad, and now we've got pills to make ourselves feel okay. So there are certain restorative tendencies in our nature, and you can think of that as a pendulum if you want, but we've got all these tricks and devices and forms of social organization to try to push that pendulum up there and to hold it so that it won't come back. As one of our poets once put it, T.S. Eliot, we're dreaming of systems so perfect that nobody has to be good. And eventually, if you hold that pendulum up there long enough, it's going to come crashing down eventually, but it might come down with such force that it smashes everything. So what you have to do is welcome the restorative tendencies of our nature. And yes, there is hope in that, because the human design is a good design. Sure, we've messed ourselves up with sin. I believe in the fall. But it isn't that there's no good left in us. It's just that all the good in us is somewhat messed up. We have those restorative tendencies built in, which come to our aid. That plus the supernatural grace of God, I think, gives us great hope.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're out of time. So you've been listening to The Mentors Radio. My guest has been the University of Texas Professor Jay Budziski, author of more than 20 books, including his more recent book, Pandemic of Lunacy. To learn more or listen again, visit thementorsradio.com. There you will find show notes and links to the professor's books and a website, undergroundthomist.org. And like all our other episodes, this episode is available as a podcast on all other platforms. Just search thementorsradio.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week at the same time. Until then, I'm Tom Laurie, signing off. Remember, be all you can be and keep the candle lit for those who struggle in the darkness.
It's been The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business. To get more information about the program or a sponsor, to download a podcast of today's show, or to leave a question for our host, go to thementorsradio.com. That's www.thementorsradio.com. The preceding program, copyright CBJ LLC, all rights reserved.